This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our book week continues with Ricky Jay, a master sleight-of-hand artist and a spellbinding performer. His one-man shows, Ricky Jay on the Stem, and Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants, were directed by David Mamet. Jay has acted in the Mamet films House of Games, Things Change, The Spanish Prisoner, State in Maine, and Heist. He's now working as a consultant to the Mamet film Sleight of Hand, which is about a 19th century magician who was America's most wanted serial killer. Ricky Jay is also a scholar of magic, con games, and sideshows. He's the author of two histories of unusual entertainments, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, and Jay's Journal of Anomalies. His latest book, Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck, is a series of reflections and historical anecdotes about dice. The book also features photographs of dice from Jay's personal collection. These don't look like ordinary dice. They are old celluloid dice, and they are decomposing. Ricky Jay, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to describe what the decaying dice look like.
Boy, it's actually difficult to describe, but over a period of years and years, dice which are made from celluloid nitrate in this case, which was the industry standard probably up till about the middle of the last century, eventually begin to break down. And they break down in the most amazing ways. I mean, they start, you see crystallization on the corners of the dice, and they move to the edges, and eventually fissures occur and stress and imploding of dice, where you can wind up with actual crumbling pieces, with the paint used to mark the pips on the dice moving, with the dice taking absolutely extraordinary shape, where the colors change, where material which might have been in the dice, both in the makeup of the celluloid, which would be cotton fibers and camphor in addition to sulfuric and nitric acid, but also if the dice were, how shall we say, adapted for use by cheaters. So if there were things within the dice, you may see them coming out. You may see oxidation. And this series of photographs which Rosamond took were absolutely stunning. I mean, just stunning.
I want to add that on some of these decaying dice, you actually see mold growing, and there is something so creepy about it. And I think part of what makes these photos so exciting to me is that they're inert substances that are dying as if they were organisms. And it's almost like a definition of surrealism. You know that surrealistic image of the cup that is fur-lined?
Oh, yeah.
This is what these dice remind me of, this, like, almost unholy combination of inertness and life. How did you start collecting dice?
Well, I suppose one could call them tools of my trade. I mean, as a sleight-of-hand artist, both magic and gambling techniques often involve dice, and so they're wonderful objects. And over the years, I realized without consciously trying to amass an enormous collection of them that I did have thousands of pairs of dice coming from disparate sources, from gamblers who reformed and took to other fields for their financial support, from collectors, from friends who would give me dice. And eventually I had many of them. And over the course of years, this breakdown of the dice, this decay and exposure, managed to make them create these unusual, incredibly unusual objects.
When you started collecting dice, did you have any idea that they were going to decay, or did they just surprise you and start doing it?
No idea at all. It was a complete surprise. I mean, I had seen dice in various states of decay. And, of course, older dice, really old dice, bone dice, ivory dice, don't decay in this way. This is, a man-made process. Celluloid is the first commercially successful manufactured plastic. So I suppose it should have a fate that suits that.
Now, these dice made out of celluloid, they disintegrate for the same reason that old celluloid film disintegrates, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, the photographer says that these dice smell also. Do they smell a lot?
They do. And I must say, keeping them in my house for a period of years, I would occasionally, at the request of my wife or various other visitors, have to move them into more secluded areas. I kept them in largely in old plastic drawers and in a cupboard, and then you would not notice this rather odoriferous eminence. But If you took them out of the drawers, you certainly would.
How have you used dice over the years?
Well, just as objects to conjure with, I suppose, is the best way to express that. There are lovely effects that can be done with dice. Mysteries, effects of skill, and if one were choosing to talk about gambling or hustling, you could demonstrate, in fact, various things that could be done with dice.
You quote your grandfather who said that he was a magician, and he said he never played with cards because if he lost, he was thought to be an incompetent magician, and if he won, he was suspected to be a cheater. I was figuring that would probably be true with dice also.
Well, it is. I think I actually mention it in that aspect in the book because of the same thing, of people being suspected of being cheaters if they simply won. I mean, that bears to mind one of, I think, the most interesting anecdotes in the book. In 1544, we find the first serious account of cheating with dice in the English language. And of all places, it appears in a study on archery called Toxophilus by Roger Ascham. And in it, he talks about what I think is just a truly diabolical method of a cheater gaining his advantage. So he says in this particular game, a man that the cheaters want to take for their money is actually winning honestly. So what they do is to switch false dice into the game, let the honest man throw the dice once and accuse him of cheating and then take his winnings. And that's in 1544. I mean, the level of duplicity is just wonderfully modern.
How are loaded dice made? Like, what's the principle there?
Well, the principle is that a foreign substance is placed into the dice at some specific spot to make it favor the throwing of certain points. So I think that's a reasonably accurate analysis of this. So that if it's heavier on one side, it'll make that side would tend to be thrown to the bottom so that the opposite side would surface. And various materials could have been used over the years, lead, gold, quicksilver, mercury. And then the placing of these loads within the dice became more and more sophisticated.
And what are the first forms of dice that you found in your research?
Well, I think it's pretty safe to say that dice come from astragali, which are the heel bones of hoofed quadrupeds. And this particular bone was quite attractive and six-sided and took well to decoration. And they say that the heel bone of the antelope was particularly handsome, and that was really prized by the throwers of astragali. And we think that only four sides were actually used in these dice games. And the evolution from astragal to dice is, at least to my knowledge, not based on any single event, that it takes place gradually over a period of years and years.
You actually reprint a quote from... it's a craps dealer, and his wrapper has come on. Do you have your book with you?
Yeah.
Could I ask you to turn to page 38? Maybe you know this by heart.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do this for you.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, get your money down. It's betting time. The hard 6 and the hard 8 gets you 7-1. The hard 10, the hard 4 gets you 8-1. I repeat, get your money down. It's betting time, and we're off. Coming out for a point, bet the big 11. 7 is a crap. Bet the field. They come or they don't come. 5 and after 5, the field. They come or they don't come. Leave your money set and win a big bet. Don't cut it thin or you won't win. Leave it go and watch it grow. And the winner, 5 on the front line. And we're coming out for another point. Iolev, the winner.
What year is that from?
Boy, I would guess that's probably the litany of a craps dealer in the 50s or 60s. You know, just somebody doing their spiel trying to get someone to lay down money in a casino situation.
Are there many casinos where you have people who can do the spiel as well?
I think that becomes a dying art. It's very much like Carney, which we've talked about on past shows together, that the language of the Carney and the Carney come-on has changed enormously, that you used to have an outside talker, someone that would do the pitch, and that they would repeat this pitch over and over again. And the very concept of that has basically been replaced by a tape-recorded loop. And I think in large casinos, people think, certainly in the really classy casinos of Vegas, that a spiel like that is somehow an unfair inducement to bad betting. So I think in both cases they're dying out, sadly.
Why do you think the underworld and illicit activities have always had their own language?
Well, this becomes a very complex question, and one for someone whose skills are in areas other than mine. But I think the general thing that you hear is the idea that this language is used to be exclusionary. But I think people who study this carefully will tell you that's rarely the case. Perhaps the only thing that comes to mind as an absolutely exclusionary use of real language is the language of the pickpocket, where the pickpocket, the hook, the wire, the dip, the cannon, the man who actually takes the wallet, talks to his shill, his confederate, his stick, his stall, and literally gives him directions in actual conversation that would allow the stall to know where to set up and what pocket the dip wants to reach to take the wallet away. And the idea that that actually happens during the transmission of the crime is pretty wonderful to me. But it's the most specific example that I can think of.
So that they can talk in code and no one will understand.
Right. And then the concept of the office, which is giving a signal. It's a wonderful 18th century term that's still used by gamblers all the time. It's a method of communicating from one gambler to another. It could be silent. It could be through language. Now that I say that, I mean it can be used in a Monte game with the operator telling the shill by language. The shill can't follow which is the actual card to be chosen, you know, where the queen is amongst the two black sixes. And so the operator, in the course of doing his spiel, will actually manage to tell the shill which card he should bet on.
Before you became a master of the con game and a historian of the con, were you ever taken? I mean, when you started to really love this stuff, before you knew how it worked, did you play three-card Monte and lose all the time? Did you play dice and with people who were cheating but you didn't quite know how, so you were losing?
Let me say that I have been in card games and games of chance in which people were moving. That's the correct term. People were absolutely moving. And sometimes you can determine it while it's happening, and other times you might have to go back after the game and recall, aha, that must have been what happened in this situation. I think anybody who thinks that they can't be cheated in a game is the perfect person for you to play against.
Why?
Because they're clearly suckers. Anybody can be cheated. I mean, they're just levels and new work that's being done all the time.
Your Journal of Anomalies, which was like a very handsome, almost newsletter that you would occasionally publish, featuring anomalies, freaks, and freaks from history, unusual performers through history. You collected that a while ago into an actual book. Why are you so interested in people who would be known as freaks?
Well, I think I sometimes say that I'm not so interested in people who were just, for instance, Siamese twins don't particularly interest me, but Siamese twins who play the violin interest me enormously. It's a bit glib, but I think you see where I'm going.
Right, exactly.
That I really am interested in people who would overcome extraordinary difficulties and become, you know, just absolutely fascinating people. One man who actually crosses over to both books is a man we've talked about before, Matthew Buchinger, one of my true favorites, a man who was born in 1674 and was only 28 inches tall and had no arms or legs and was an extraordinary magician, which is how I got interested in him. But he also played more than 8 musical instruments and danced the hornpipe and did trick bowling shots and fired pistols. And he also was a dicer. Matter of fact, I have this couplet about him in the book. He throws the dice as careless down as any gamester in the town, and though the number cast be 3, 2 sixes you shall ever see. the idea of this 28-inch man who was actually had no arms or legs, but he had two. Well, I guess the easiest way to describe his appendages were like the thalidomide flippers that we saw in this country some 20 or 30 years ago, but his enormous accomplishments are just absolutely intriguing to me. And he also, amazingly enough, was an extraordinary calligrapher. And I've managed over the years to build up a collection of original pieces of his calligraphy, often done on vellum, sometimes on paper in the early years of the 18th century. And because they were so good, they were saved, and I've been able to put together a rather remarkable holding of this. But I think he may be the man that I'm most interested in the world. I mean, it's just such an extraordinary level of accomplishment, and also in an age where these people were exhibited in horrible situations. Here was a man who was allowed to have a real education, you know, who had an interesting family life, who had many descendants who became accomplished in their own rights. I think his grandson was at one point considered the best lute player in England. Buckingham himself had 4 wives and 14 children. So he's just, to me, endlessly fascinating.
Where do you go to learn more about him?
Well, I don't know. I suppose every time that I'm on the road, this is one of the pleasures of my life. If I'm in a city performing, I manage to go to libraries and museums and bookstores and print shops in search of material. And in that way, I've been able to unearth a lot of material about him.
Huh.
And various other people that I write about as well.
Do you think there's any contemporary equivalent of the freak show now?
Well, there still are some shows like this running. And you know, a man named Ward Hall, another man named Bobby Reynolds still put on shows like this that are great fun. And, you know, it's considered a dying entertainment on the level that there are far less of these shows than there once were. And politically, they're rather peculiar as well, but often... one has to talk to the person who's being exhibited, and often those people feel like they have an honest way to make a living and are not being exploited at all. But this is a difficult political issue. I mean, I love this world, the world of the carny.
Well, Ricky J., a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thanks very much indeed.
Ricky J.'s latest book is called Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. Our interview was recorded in December after the book was published.